To talk about professional ethics, pastoral ethics, we're not going to talk about medical ethics, an extremely important field, but it's not one that we're going to give attention to it this morning. We're not going to talk about integrity in doctrine and practice, although obviously that's important as well and part of ethics. Rather, we're going to talk about what does it mean to be and to practice one's ministry above reproach, as is written in 1 Timothy 3. I want to first define, by the way, all of you would hopefully have two handouts. If you don't, they're in the back. First, let me give you a definition of boundaries. Boundaries are limits that allow for safe contact or connection in a pastoral or professional to a parishioner relationship based on the parishioner's needs. So boundaries permit safe contact, acceptable, respectable, professional contact between the pastor and the parishioner based on the parishioner's needs. Boundaries are very complex, and they're comprised of a number of things. Contributing to those boundaries, each of us have boundaries, we'll talk about what they look like in a moment, are our theological assumptions, our personality, our own history, family history, our culture, our nationality, our race, and society's mores. All of that go into contributing to who we are and what kind of boundary we have around ourselves. Talk about your boundaries as a would-be pastor, soon to be, some of you, and the parishioner's boundaries. Now, if we had a chalkboard, I'd put this on the chalkboard, so I'm going to ask you to use your imagination. There are at least five kinds of boundaries, if we were to draw them on a board, what that would look like. First, imagine a black pen, one circle. That would be the healthiest boundary. That's a boundary which is flexible, a boundary which is well-defined. You know who you are. You know whose you are. You understand what your professional identity is, yet at the same time, you're able to be influenced by others. So you can influence, and you recognize the authority of your office and your personhood. At the same time, you can be touched by others, influenced by others, appropriately attended to by others in the right context, in the right relationship. That would be the healthiest of boundaries. Now imagine, draw a circle with that same pen and make it a sort of dotted line, a dotted circle. That would be a kind of boundary, a kind of person who can easily be violated, be taken advantage of. Someone, for example, who would have difficulty saying no, of being concrete, who might have difficulty stating their theological position. Well, what does God teach on this? So in a theological debate with somebody else, for example, might just sort of lay low and not express themselves. Or if something is going on in a meeting about which they don't approve, it might be difficult for them to confront that. So that kind of person has difficulty with confrontation, both giving and receiving. Then imagine another kind of boundary, another kind of person. Take this black pen and draw circle after circle after circle until you have a thick black boundary or circle all the way around. Here we're talking about somebody who is inflexible, somebody who is rigid, somebody who is entrenched in their position, who cannot be influenced. And whereas the person with the dotted line might have difficulty saying no, the person with a thick line has no difficulty at all. And they tend to be pushy, push their ways into people, push their opinions on people, enjoy confrontation, like a good argument. Oftentimes are seen as people of the law, of the letter of the law, with little spirit of the law as part of that. Then there are another kind of boundary. This time imagine a bunch of circles, a bunch of dots in a circle, kind of row, or I mean circle after circle, inner circle after dots, and then when you get toward the core, draw a black line. Well, here's a person who seems to be able to invite people in to get to know them, sometimes unknowingly, unconsciously invites people into their space, into relationships, but at their inner core have some very definite, strong beliefs about themselves. And oftentimes, those beliefs are fears. Fears that come from a history of abuse, perhaps, or painful experiences. And so you come into a relationship with this kind of a person and you think everything's going well, all of a sudden you hit this boundary and you don't know what's happened. And the person can turn against you or can react against you in a way, a strong way, that's very confusing. The last or the fifth boundary I would suggest is one that is sort of a circle where you have a line and then a little space and then a bigger line and another space and a dot and another space and a line. And so what you have is a person who is developing a healthy, strong boundary, but still has some gaps. It has some uncertainties about himself. Questions perhaps his identity. Do I really belong in the ministry? What is this call about, going into parish ministry or institutional ministry? Does God really want me there? So their identity is still not clearly formed, and they're in the process of being formed. Those are different kinds of boundaries, and there are perhaps others that I haven't thought about. Each of you have one of those boundaries, or something that looks like it, as does Dean Smith and myself. And everybody in your parish has one of those boundaries too. And they aren't all the same. And we get a variety of those people that we minister to. So now if you were in a class of clinical pastoral education with me, one of the things I would ask you to do, and you could even do it on the paper in front of you if you like, is, and yet don't do it now, but think about this if you would please, for yourself and for the sake of your ministry. Put your name and perhaps your identity as a pastor or somebody who wants to be a pastor, and draw the appropriate boundary around yourself, around your name. See if you can figure out who you are. Just keep this between you, yourself, and yourself, or maybe your spouse. Or perhaps, if you're privileged and blessed, a counselor or a spiritual mentor, pastor. And then draw another circle around the word parishioner. But before you write that word parishioner and draw a circle around it, I want you to think, where would that word parishioner be in appropriate proximity to me as pastor? In other words, should my name as pastor be here, this circle, and should this parishioner be here? Should this parishioner be right beside me as a friend in Christ? Should this parishioner be up here, since my call from God is through that congregation, and I should be in submission to their authority? Where would you put yourself if future pastor, in relationship to those parishioners. How you understand that is very important when it comes to professional ethics. If you see yourself at an equal level with them, as one who wants to develop close friendships, intimate friendships, like you do as you have buddies here, or as you might have with your wife, although we could get into a theological debate about that, we will not. But if you develop that kind of close relationship with your parishioners, you run a great risk of violating one or more parishioners. And so I would suggest to you that the appropriate positioning is that we are called servants of God, but we are also called with authority. And we're going to talk about power in a moment. But we do have a power and authority, and if you lose sight of that, brothers, sister, you run great risk of violating other people. So think of yourself, I would suggest, as over your people, but they're not so much under you, but you do have authority and power and responsibility. I'd like to suggest that there are three kinds of power at work in ourselves as ministers. First, there is the power of God. This is all under Roman numeral 2b, yours and parishioners. Talking about boundaries still. Three kinds of power at work in ministry. First is the power of God. We sometimes lose sight of that power. But imagine that. Think about that. Meditate on the fact that we have been called by God. That the power of God through Jesus Christ lives within us. Imagine that. Imagine the authority of our office. What a privilege we have, and how humbling and how scary that is to think about the awesomeness of the responsibility that you and I have as spiritual leaders with a group of people. So the power of God is at work with us in our call, in His Word. It's within us. It's part of our identity, who we are as ministers of God. Second kind of power at work, I would suggest, is unilateral power. Unilateral power is the ability to produce an intended effect to the advance of one's own purposes. So unilateral seeks to effect change, but effect change that serves me, Joel, or you as pastor. Third kind of power is relational power. This is to the ability to influence others and to be influenced by others. So one that sees value in relationship, one that listens to the needs of the people and responds to those needs, while at the same time recognizing the objective truth and unilateral power of the Word of God, and how that then brings to bear on the people we serve. And keeping that kind of tension, hopefully, is a creative tension, but it is not an easy tension. To remember the Word of God and the ultimate power and authority of the Word of God, while at the same time listening to the people and responding to the people. Now, where it gets confusing and contaminated is when our own needs get involved, when we want to affect change because it's our need, not God's need, but our need, because it serves us rather than the people we've been called to serve. That's when we run a major risk of becoming abusive and violating other people and breaking this ethical code to which all of us have been called. C. When are we out of bounds? When do we move beyond healthy boundaries? When do we move into somebody else's boundaries and violate that person? If I were to walk over here to Dean Smith, Dean Smith has a boundary around himself, and he will tell me when I've gotten too close. Hey, he wouldn't let me kiss him. Right, he's pretty comfortable with himself. He has probably very healthy boundaries. He knows himself. He knows where to draw the line. That's very important. But sometimes, if I'm not aware of this, you know, this happens in the parish. When I was the parish pastor, we had the passing of the peace, and we had some people, of course, who would pass the peace by hugging, some who would pass it by the shaking of the hand, and some with the nod of the head. The passing of the peace. Well, that all has to do with boundaries. Now, if I am a hugger and Dean Smith is not, and he offers me his hand of peace in God, and I just kind of go through it and take him into my arms, I've now violated his boundary. And he may never say anything about it, but I'm in violation. And so it becomes very important to be aware of our boundaries and other people's boundaries and when we have gone out of bounds. And the fact is, boundary violations are on a continuum from very subtle, like when you walk into somebody's space unintentionally. Now, as you saw, Dean Smith was able to invite me very close. But there are some of you guys who like a lot of space between you and the next person. That's not necessarily bad. It just is. And so if I tend to be a kind of intimate guy and I like to be close, I might move in and that person moves back. I move closer, they move back. And if we don't pay attention to that in ministry, for example, we can very subtly violate that boundary and be out of bounds. Or it can be on the same continuum all the way to end to being a legal violation. And we see it all the time. And district presidents, all 36 of them, tell us it's the most painful part of their ministry is dealing with boundary violations. You know by whom? By guys like you and me. Not evil people. Not people who have been called and graduated from the seminary with the intent to hurt people. Just normal guys like us who don't recognize the subtle ways in which we're out of bounds. And that can grow and grow to the point where we are violating people and abusing people and not even be aware of it. Or if we are aware of it, deny it. You also have, one of the other handouts is an ethics at risk test. Now, we're not going to go through that. I would ask you, in the privacy of your own space, to complete one of these. And then to score yourself. It comes out of the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists and has been edited a couple of times. But I just want to bring to your attention a number of these for your consideration. Number two, code of ethics. Do you know that the Missouri Synod has a code of ethics, a code of professional ethics? How many of you have seen this document? Thank you. Put your hands down. How many of you have read this document? Very good. If you have had this class and have seen this document and have not read it, you are in violation and you're at risk. Now, there is so much that comes to you during a class that it's so difficult to integrate all of that and to make it a part of your ministry and life. But this is called Commitments of the Shepherd, Principles of Conduct for Ordained Ministers of the Gospel, adopted by the Council of Presidents, September 1990. If you don't have one or you haven't taken the class yet, I would encourage you to pick up a copy and to read it. It's pretty good. It's not as thorough as I would like to see it, but it's pretty good. Districts sometimes have their own code of ethics. Find out whatever district you're from or whatever district you go to, what that code is. Make sure you understand what's expected of you as a professional. I asked one district president if they have any code of ethics. He was unaware of this. He directed me to 1 Timothy chapter 3. That's a pretty good code, but it is not as thorough. Life has become very complicated, and we need to spell out some things that are going to be helpful and useful to us. Number 4, do you keep gratuities and honoraria for services rendered without clear agreement of the congregation or institution? Something very important to work out with your parish when you get there. What do you do with fees received for weddings, funerals? What about gifts? What about, you know, somebody brought me a big sausage one time. What do you do with that? What about all those Christmas gifts that your parishioners like to give to you? Should you keep those? Are they considered part of your salary? Very important to work that out with your parish, with whatever, wherever you're serving. 5, do you feel sexually attracted to any of your parishioners? It's not an issue if you do. It's when you do. If you are a normal human being, you will have sexual feelings. That's not bad. It's temptation. But you and I will never be above temptation. But you and I do not have to give in to that temptation. And when you stand up there in that pulpit or in that chancel, you can rest assured that you have people in the congregation, women and perhaps men, who will be sexually attracted to you. Now, you think maybe you're not a hunk? What is it about you that somebody would be sexually attracted to you? Don't be confused about that. You don't have to look like a movie star or a soap opera star for somebody to be attracted to you. People can put on you what some of you understand to be transferences. They will put on you, they will see in you a father, a brother. They will see in you, if you're a sensitive, caring man, and you respond to people warmly, and if they have a schmuck for a husband who is insensitive and unresponsive, you don't have to look like an extremely handsome man to receive that person's attraction. What are you going to do with it? It's very important that you and I take action to talk with a spiritual mentor, a trusted colleague, a fellow pastor, someone we know can keep things to themselves. Not your wife. Find a trusted mentor you can be completely open with. 10, are you friends with members of your parish or other employees of an institution over whom you have power or for whom you are a minister? There's a difference between being friendly and being friends. I strongly encourage you not to be friends with parishioners. Now, I know some of you might think, well, Jesus is friend. Jesus is totally above reproach. And you and I can befriend in a spiritual sense. We can befriend people. But to be friends opens us up to vulnerabilities. It makes it difficult sometimes to confront someone when we need to confront them about something, when we are close friends or we have received special gifts from them or privileges or services. And as pastors, as you and I distinguish properly between law and gospel, sometimes we have to deliver the law to someone. And if we are too close to them, it may be difficult to do that. Number 11, do you commonly take off your jewelry, remove shoes, loosen your tie, or become more informal when you are professionally on duty? This is an example of why it's so hard to be a parish pastor. Because those parishioners who see you in your vestments on Sunday morning will also see you in shorts at the picnic and see you in different contexts. And it has a way of fuzzying the boundaries. And you and I don't have the same kind of jobs where we sit in an office and somebody comes to us and they only see us when we're in our professional clothes. So it makes it that much more important for you and I to be aware of where boundary violations can occur. 12, do you hug or touch the people to whom you minister indiscriminately and or in the privacy of your office? I'm not saying that touching is forbidden completely or that hugging is forbidden. Sometimes a person will be in grief and you do a funeral like I did the other day. You have a funeral for somebody, and they walk up to you and they collapse into your arms. Well, you're not going to leave your arms down there, let them fall to the floor. You hold them and you care for them. You touch them in an appropriate way. But to touch indiscriminately, because you touch everybody, because you're an intimate kind of guy, because you're a hugger, it may mean that you have not yet graduated from the 70s. It was okay back then, at least we thought it was, and it created a lot of trouble. But touching can be very warm and caring when it's done appropriately, but not indiscriminately. And the important thing is to know when to touch, who to touch, where to touch, what to touch, and especially why you are touching. Self-awareness is extremely important. Extremely important. Otherwise, you might be touching out of your need rather than the person who is hurting in front of you. Number 15. Do you ever use a client or parishioner to provide you with a product or professional service free of charge? I've already alluded to that. That can complicate your life too. It's very easy, guys, to be in the parish and go to the mechanic in your parish and receive free work on your car. Go to the dentist, receive free dental service. Go to the doctor, receive free medical care. Be very careful about that. Sometimes it can be confusing to that parishioner, maybe not consciously, but more subtly, as to what the relationship is between you. What is the authority? You are the spiritual authority over that dentist and that mechanic and have responsibilities to them. Don't compromise yourself by accepting gifts that can later come back to bite you. Number 18. Do you find yourself often talking about your personal or family situations with clients and parishioners? Making some kind of an innocuous reference to your family or some humorous story, as we do in preaching and teaching sometimes, we have to decide about that. That's where some of the confusion comes in for us as professionals in the pulpit. You have to be careful, though, how much you reveal about yourself and whether or not that makes other people uncomfortable. Some people don't want to know all these intimate details about your family. So you have to be guarded as to what you say and when you say it. Number 22, do you feel manipulated by a current client or parishioner such that you are wary of them or angry and frustrated by them? If you have a lot of feeling reaction, and I know some of you are thinkers and don't have much feeling reaction at all. That's not bad either, or good, just is. But if you find yourself being restless in your body, or feelings you're not familiar with, or you're uncomfortable with, if you find yourself thinking about somebody, a parishioner, quite a bit away from the time you're with them, that's a red flag. It may be that it's important to talk with another individual, another trusted colleague, about what's going on inside of you, why the reaction in you, what's the feeling about. Because people can anger us, provoke us. People are a pain in the butt sometimes. I mean, you just want to kick them, or at least get away from them somehow. Kick them out of the church. But those feelings are as real as the sexual attraction. But we need to deal with them in a constructive way. 24, have you wanted to talk to a colleague about a current case or parishioner, but feared doing so would show your lack of skill or lead to an ethics case against you? This is where some of the continuum of boundary violations from subtle to legal violations, that's how it develops. The subtle stuff starts happening. We start becoming uncomfortable and aware of it, but we're afraid to do something about it, afraid to acknowledge that we have clay feet, that we are sinners with the rest of them. And so we hold this stuff inside of us rather than going to somebody we trust. Not to gossip, but to talk openly, to get some help, some counsel. Sometimes we're even smart enough, wise enough, to seek professional counseling. Most of us, at some point during our life, need professional counseling. Whether or not we get it is something else. And the last one, 26. Do you talk about clients or parishioners with other clients or parishioners or gossip about them with colleagues or your wife? As a pastor since 1971, it is amazing to me how many pastors will talk to other pastors about parishioners, about things they should not be talking. It's one thing to get consultation. It's something else just to talk about somebody in light conversation. And you know as well as I do how many disparaging comments are made about our other brothers in the ministry. It's really sad that we are such violators of that particular code of ethics. If you would, think about this. Take that test for yourself. Be completely honest. Page 2. One of the best books I've read on the subject of professional ethics is a book by Marilyn Peterson, At Personal Risk. She talks about three key ingredients to boundary violations. First key ingredient is when the roles between us and the parishioner is reversed. The parishioner becomes the caretaker, responding to us, taking care of us. That's why you have to be careful that you're not too self-revelatory about current struggles in your life. Because if you are, then very sensitive people want to respond and take care of us and nurture us. And it's not bad on their part because you and I have set them up. Now, we may need to talk about ourselves to some trusted colleague or professional, but we don't want to open up and fuzzy or gray those boundaries between the parishioner and ourselves. Or the roles are reversed when the pastoral office or power is used to intentionally or unintentionally further one's personal gains. He may not mean to do it. But what you mean to do is only part of the issue. What you've done, how you've hurt, is the greater issue. Second ingredient, the parishioner is caught in a double bind. The parishioner respects you, your office, perhaps needs you as their pastor, is afraid of losing you as a pastor, yet at the same time they can feel trapped by something that just doesn't seem right. There's something wrong about this relationship. I feel too close to you. I think about you too much. I've got secrets I'm keeping. And so they're in this double bind, what to do. Do they confront you? Do they go to the elder and talk to the chief elder about you? But they'll get you in trouble, and they care about you so much. They don't want to lose you. Number three, the secret is kept. Very dangerous to have secrets. I would hope that each of you, one of the first things you do after you graduate from the seminary and receive your first call is that you find a spiritual mentor for yourself. Maybe it is the circuit counselor, but maybe it's not. The circuit counselor may or may not have the gifts you're looking for, but find someone you can go to, a companion that you can be totally honest with and keep no secrets from. That person will be a tremendous resource to you. Roman numeral three, proactive steps to professional ethics. You and I are called as servants to serve other people. It's also critically important that we remember our authority. We are servants with authority. And if you disregard that authority and see yourself only as servant, then you're not going to recognize the power that you have. Power to be creative with God and to do some incredibly wonderful things in the name of Jesus. And also the power to destroy. B. Another proactive step. Be certain you know what the Missouri Synod and your district expects of you. Read the most current official statements on clergy conduct. C. Be uncompromisingly truthful with yourself. Know thyself, brother, sister. Know thyself. Your history, your family of origin, how you have perhaps been wounded in life, how your personality may be scarred, any unfinished business that's still a part of your life that needs to be worked out. Those are not bad things, guys. Those are just real. They're just human. They come with being a pastor, like any other profession. It's what you and I do with them. How well we attend to them so they don't get in the Holy Spirit's way of working through us. D. Commit to ongoing peer consultation. You've already heard me say that 4 or 5 times. It's because it's so important. We talk about having pastors, our wives having pastors, because we're not their pastor. Yet we don't often do enough about it. And there are too many lone rangers serving as pastors who are hurting and not seeking out the help. And if you establish that consultative relationship very early on in your ministry, in that first year, because you're going to need it, there's scary stuff going out there. It's exciting, but it's scary too. you have that relationship established so that 5 years down the row, when your marriage isn't so going so well, or your kid is acting out, or you've got this midlife crisis going on inside of you, you already have this relationship established where you can be completely honest with somebody. God will bless you. E, develop and maintain a healthy social life. Sometimes workaholic pastors can get so involved in their work, that's all they have, even to the neglect of their families, neglect of their personal lives. And so they're just a setup. They've set themselves up to get involved in an unhealthy relationship with somebody from their parish or outside the parish, the secretary, the organist. You've heard the stories. And it doesn't have to be that way. It's important that you and I find friends and have a life outside of our context of ministry. And finally, stay current. Read, go to workshops, seminars, presentations on the subject of clergy conduct, what's expected, what's happening legally in this field. It affects us. It's important to know that. And finally, though it's not there, I would hope that all of you, when you get to the parish, make sure that you have liability insurance. You hate to even think about that. But that your congregation carries a policy that covers your work as a pastor. Because even though you could be completely innocent, there are some sick people in your parish. And it just takes one of them to bring a case against you, innocent or not. And it can create all kinds of hell. And so having that policy, not too big because it invites people, but big enough that it can cover you. We have some time for comments or questions if you would like to ask any or make any statements.
Thank you, Reverend Hempel, for the informative lecture. Two questions regarding the test. When talking about feeling sexually attracted towards parishioners, you mentioned not talking to your wife about that. And I was wondering if you could explore that a little bit in terms of issues of accountability with your wife. And secondly, in dealing with favors from parishioners, a second question, could you kind of tease that out a little bit more regarding patronage of your parishioners' businesses rather than maybe somewhere else in the community in order to help your parishioners out?
Let me speak to the last one first. I'm not saying one should not patronize the services of your parishioners. I'm saying pay for it. So, yeah, support your parishioners if you want to, although sometimes that can be problematic too when the mechanic does not do the job the way you'd like. I tell you, one of the biggest mistakes I ever made, I made a lot of them, but one of the biggest mistakes I made as a pastor in the parish is that I had a couple in counseling, and their marriage became very strong, and praise God, it worked out well for them, and they stayed married, and the family got stronger. He was a carpenter, and he was not doing as well as he would like, and he was an excellent carpenter, and I hired him to do some work for us at our home. Well, the man was good, but he took forever. I mean, he took forever, and he could not change his pattern ways, and so I had to fire him. Now, even though they were not parishioners, if they ever needed a counselor again, I sure was not available to him. He was now angry at me. His father was a parishioner, and he was angry at me. Not a good idea. So you have to be very cautious when you even make use of those services that it doesn't create problems for you. And if you accept free services, sometimes it's you develop an attitude that it's very hard to deal with that person if that person needs some admonishment, some confrontation, because they have taken very good care of you. And you and I, as human beings, can even let that get in the way because we don't want to lose that special privilege that we have received. free dentistry, that's no small gift. Free mechanical work, we don't want to lose that. So I'm not saying it has to be, but I'm saying it creates the possibility of boundary violation. In terms of talking with your wife versus not talking with your wife about sexual attractions, first let me say, I do not believe you should talk to your wife about anything that happens in your professional life as pastors. Doesn't belong there. She is not the called pastor. You carry a lot of weight on your shoulders as pastor. Yes, you need to talk about that. But you run the risk of violating confidences when you talk with your wife. And when you talk with your wife has not necessarily made the same commitment to confidentiality that you have. And she can unintentionally let it slip that you've said something to her and she says something to somebody else. I can't tell you the number of times in the parish when parishioners have called my home, asked for me, I haven't been there, my wife Marcia picks up the phone, they start talking to her about whatever it is, very personal thing. Marcia says, wait a minute, I don't want you to think that I know anything about this, I know nothing about this, and perhaps you shouldn't be telling me about this. Rather than Marcia listening and commenting back to her or him about it, giving that impression. So generally speaking, I, for one, am opposed. I know others would disagree with that. In terms of sexual feelings, sometimes it can create a kind of tension between you and your wife that you don't need to have there. However, if it has become something that's getting in your way of the marriage, then it becomes important that you do, because you have to deal with your marriage and make sure that it stays healthy or gets healthy. But sometimes the wife, as she's telling you about the sexual attraction she's having to some man in the parish, you may not have an understanding or an appreciation of that. And there may be an unnecessary offense given when you can constructively deal with that with a trusted person, a counselor, without having to go there. But if it's getting in your way, getting in the way of the marriage relationship, then you do need to talk about it.
I'm John Duke. I'm the man program here. I don't know who sent out this code of ethics book so long ago, but I found that most pastors don't know that it exists. I've counseled with some over a period of time, and they have no idea that it's out. Usually what I have to do is go back to CFW Author's Church and Ministry, because it contains basically the same things that the Code of Ethics books contained that were sent out. But I don't know whether you have any connection or whoever has connection with getting this book out even to pastors who are going out into the field, because they have no idea that it actually exists. And you refer to it and say, look, you know, we already have guidelines here that lay this out pretty clear. You know, why aren't we talking on this basis? And they say, well, I've never heard of it. And I'm talking about one learned pastor who writes articles for one of our official periodicals. He himself had no idea that it existed.
There is so much material to read, as you all know, that come across your plate from a variety of sources, now and in the parish. It's hard to stay on top of that. So guys in the parish, they'll get this, and they may see it, but if they feel like they don't have a problem, or they know that they are pastoring correctly, and they read C.F.W. Walther one time 20 years ago, then they know what's there. Well, they may not know what's there. And it's hard to remember these things. And there aren't enough workshops offered in districts that help to bring to attention documents like this. Books, it wasn't until 1978, I graduated in 71 through the seminary, late 60s, wasn't until 1978 that some of the books began to be published about conduct, professional ethics, sexual misconduct. 1978. So there are an awful lot of guys out there who, unless they have somehow had it brought to their attention and taken initiative, will not be aware of what's expected of them.
Thank you very much, Pastor Hemper. I heard your address more cross-culturally, you know, in this kind of problem of human relations as pastors and parishioners and the like. Now, my question is, I have been hearing in recent years in America, of course, I heard in other parts of the world too, that is some of the things what you said that today is really a problem. In fact, I heard hundreds of our pastors, even sometimes thousands, who knows, pastors are having difficulty related to what you have just explained. Now, my question is it this somewhat new phenomena prevailing today, or let us say since 1970s or 80s or something like that, or was that problem was really a problem even before that? Now, if this is a new problem, what are some of the reasons for these type of problem are increasing? That is really, to my mind, is very serious. I have some idea, but I'd really like to hear from you as an expert, so that really we can look at from the wider perspectives rather than just one group of people known as clergy. But I'm sure in the society, this is also a problem too. That is related to interpersonal relationship and how to relate this or that and so forth, so on. Thank you very much.
Some of the question basically was, is this a new phenomenon, this kind of misconduct, or has it been with us since the beginning of time? Well, we know it's been with us since the beginning of time because of sin. What we don't have is good research on what happened generations before us. We've become more aware of it in the latter 20, 30 years. And so what has brought that awareness, by the way, it's estimated that 7 to 12% of men, professional men, including pastors, are in violation of sexual misconduct. Just sexual. We're not talking about all these other areas where we run the risk of being in violation. And that 3 to 5% of women, professionals, however, that may be increasing too. What has caused the increase of awareness and perhaps the increase of violation? One, I think, is the sexual revolution, so-called sexual revolution, that even has had its impact on us people of God to loosen our boundaries, to loosen our sexual boundaries. Also, there was this big revolution, you remember, some of you, yeah, I can look around at the amount of gray hair here, some of you remember the 70s, and you remember the kind of revolution that was. We were into touching and these encounter groups. Encounter groups was the way to go. And you, in fact, I was trained in a pastoral counseling center where I was working on my master's. We did group therapy. This is the truth. We did group therapy in a room, an open room, with nothing but pillows and mattresses. There were no chairs. I mean, that was a setup. Now, we thought we were conscious of boundaries. I would go into the counseling center. This was in Dayton, Ohio. I'd go to the counseling center. When I first went there, I about had a heart attack. The therapists hugged the therapists. The therapists hugged the clients. The clients hugged the therapists. The clients hugged each other. And the secretary hugged everybody. And so when I came, I thought, my gosh, an orgy is going to break out. But one of the things that was confronting in me was my own rigidity and fear of intimacy that I had to face in myself. Fear of intimacy that kept me at a distance from people. That's another story. But that kind of a atmosphere and time in our society has created, in part, a kind of openness, which we're now getting a backlash to, I believe. The whole, not just the feminism movement, but women becoming stronger and being willing to take less violation of one kind or the other and speaking out against it, not permitting sexual innuendo, not permitting jokes, sexist or sexually oriented jokes and confronting us as men about that. There's been a real change in that. And so there is more and more courage on the part of individuals to confront the behavior that's always been there, but perhaps has even increased over these last years, especially since the 70s. There was somebody here first, I think, Dr. Warnick.
Reverend Hempel, thank you very much. Your message has been very informative and helpful. My question is regarding, particularly directed at single people, single pastors in the parish, and the development of interpersonal relationships and the idea that probably most single pastors that are starting in ministry probably do not want to be single their entire life. So the question arises then, how do we develop those interpersonal relationships if it is deemed inappropriate to even develop friendships within the congregations? How do you develop relationships that that might lead to eventual marriage with a particular female, whether it be in your congregation or somewhere else, given the fact that you would want someone to be of the Lutheran persuasion? Thank you.
Well, I think it's a great question, and I would like to answer that question from my 26-year-old son. He has the same kind of dilemma, and not that he's a pastor, but that he does not, it's hard to meet good Christian women. You know, if I were a single pastor and I had the confidence then as I do now, and I didn't have the confidence then, are you single, brother? I would encourage you to, if you at all have any kind of organizing ability, to, when you go to whatever city you go to look at the possibility of developing something for women and men like you, that where you can come together. There are meat markets out there where you can meet people, but that's not, I think, what you're looking for. But you have the ability to create your own. And if not, I would encourage you to let your fellow pastors know that you're available and that you're looking for an eligible woman, and perhaps, I know this may sound strange, but perhaps some fellow pastor can set you up with a date or introduce you or talk with a particular woman in his congregation to see if that person would be open to pastor or whoever you are, telephoning them, and then the rest of it's up to you. But there are ways of making that kind of contact, but it's going to take your initiative. Dr. Warner.
Thank you. Pastor Hempel, your presentation enforces much of our pastoral ministry education here. You made several references to finding a mentor or a confidant with whom a pastor may relate and be very open. My question is, when we search for that kind of a person, must we serve that individual in a reciprocal capacity for that kind of confident relationship to be profitable to ourselves? In other words, do we have to reciprocate and be ready to reciprocate, and the other individual who serves us finds in us the kind of person that can serve them? I think it's a very difficult area. I certainly appreciate the encouragement that you've given the men to do that. But related to it is the question of whether that's really possible in very many areas of our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Collegium. You might want to speak to that.
The